and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're digging into the vault for the keynote address from the Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, recorded back in April. Hosted by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, on April 28th, green energy author and consultant Jerry Udelson on the business case for green building in Alaska is coming up next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news.
Good afternoon, folks. I'm Chris Rose with Renewable Energy Alaska Project, and I'm here to introduce our keynote speaker, Jerry Udelson. Before I do that, I just wanted to thank again all our sponsors, all the exhibitors, and all the folks who have made this event really a success for the last 3 years, and that is including our great volunteer staff, and particularly the Renewable Energy Alaska Project staff, the REAP staff. So I just want to hear a hand for the REAP staff who's put this thing together. We're very fortunate today to have Jerry Udelson as our keynote speaker at lunch. Jerry has written more books about green building than any other person. My last count, that was 12. He runs a consulting firm that has, over the last couple decades, worked with over 200 different state governments, municipal governments, businesses, and the like, trying to help them bring their bottom line down. But I think more importantly, and particularly to our issue today of how we build this movement, he's an expert in marketing the message of energy efficiency and green building. And so we're very lucky to have a person who's been doing this for so long. He started out in the renewable energy sector. You told me earlier today that he ran the first solar program in California for Governor Jerry Brown in his first term. So that was a while ago. And also was a lobbyist down in Sacramento working with the renewable energy industry when we were just getting going. So he's been involved in both renewable energy and energy efficiency, is one of the leading authorities on green building, and we're very happy to have him. Please welcome Jerry Udelson.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm very happy to be here. I guess I was here 2 years ago to give some talks and whatever. I understand we're missing some of the standard elements of Alaska cuisine, like the fermented seal flipper. It's not on the menu today. So I was enlightened by this by a gentleman who was sitting next to me, Clem, former state legislator and a longtime original Alaskan. So I'm very happy to be here. Down in the lower 48, we don't know much about Alaska except you betcha. Everyone knows that. But I wanted to talk about the business case for green building in Alaska. And the reason I like to do this is there's so many people here. Captain Hickey, we heard earlier today, you know, Jack Hebert from Fairbanks, and so many people that know the stuff, how to do the stuff right. I heard a gentleman from the Yukon talking. The technical knowledge of how to do things better is widespread. But what I find with a lot of technical people, I'm an engineer by training and a marketer by inclination and a writer by impoverished avocation. What I find with a lot of good technical people is they don't know how to persuade somebody who doesn't know as much as they do how to do the right thing. So I've decided over the last 5 or 6 years to spend my time trying to show why this is good business as well as good policy and good energy economics, etc. And so that's kind of today's talk. So what I like to do at the beginning of every talk is to give you the takeaways. One of my goals as a lunchtime or after lunch speaker is to see more eyeballs than eyelids. But I understand that with a nice sunny day and the warmth coming in here in April and a nice meal under your belt, so to speak, there may be a temptation to want to catch up on some things. So I want to give you the takeaways. And really, there's four key takeaways. Believe it or not, the world does have a climate change problem going forward. And it's likely to be extremely pronounced in places like Alaska. You're likely to see major changes in vegetation, permafrost melting, all kinds of strange things happening. And so the building sector and green building is really important for trying to control this sort of runaway CO2 in the atmosphere. The second real takeaway is that green design and development is here to stay. And even during the worst building recession in anybody's memory, in the commercial sector down 30% throughout the US and the residential sector down 50% or more, green building has continued to grow. And if you just take the lead green building system as a surrogate for green building in general, we're still adding, and I'll show you some graphs here because I did go to engineering school and so I like to show a few graphs. We're still adding 500 new projects a month to the LEED system at an average size of 100,000 square feet. So you can do the math. That's a lot of square footage. So we're still adding almost 500 million square feet a year of new green projects. The third takeaway is that there are benefits, and I'll kind of go through those with you, that are significant for all types of buildings. So it's not just commercial office buildings or university buildings. It's just any kind of building you could think of. There's a reason to go green. And the fourth is that the cost premiums have really come down. You know, when we were first starting this 10 years ago, I was one of the instructors for the LEED system, and you know, cost was on everybody's mind, and most people thought building green was going to cost you 10% more, 20% more, and that kind of perception persisted throughout the middle of the last decade. And finally, as we started to get thousands of projects built and done, we began to discover that the cost premiums are probably on the order of 2% for large green buildings. And 2% is really in the noise level. You know, most buildings carry a 5% contingency budget. When there's a lot of construction cost inflation, they might carry 10%. So if you have a 2% cost premium for all the benefits that I'm going to talk about, well, that isn't a bad deal. That's a pretty good deal, in fact. So that's kind of the takeaways. Those who have to leave early, of course. So what is a green building? You know, I think a lot of you here come from different backgrounds, a lot of people from the energy side. And, you know, the common idea is a green building is an energy efficient building. In a good part of the country, it would also be a water efficient building. But I also think that it involves land use, material selection, ultimately a building that works better for people in a lot of different dimensions. And also one that's tested and certified by an independent third party. And that's really important because for you to say I did a green building is one thing. For somebody else to certify that, test it, verify all your claims, give you sort of a seal of approval, that's when it really starts to make a difference. And so, you know, I think it's important to understand that performance verification is the next big trend in the green building area. And you heard some of that discussion this morning, David Johnson's talk. We've got lots of green buildings out there that don't perform as well as they should. We got lots of buildings. Captain Hickey was talking about what the Coast Guard's doing. Lots of buildings that don't perform as they should. And so we're really deceiving ourselves if we don't verify this. I'm actually working on another book now, which is the Lucky Number 13 book, and that is about green building performance worldwide, and actually trying to get performance data from LEED Platinum buildings and other high performance buildings and see if they really match up, and then sort of turn that around and say, well, this is how buildings should perform. But I think the key is If it doesn't perform, it's not a green building. That's kind of my mantra these days. It can be everything else nice under the sun, but if it doesn't perform on an energy, water use basis, if it doesn't perform well for people, we really shouldn't add it to kind of the models that we follow. And there was a comment, there is a zero net energy building that I'll show you a picture of here. I was talking to David Johnson from McDonough & Partners about it, and he says, well, it's a great building from an energy perspective, but it's got these huge floor plates. It's just another cube farm where we stick people. And I said, yeah, I used to work in one of those places 10 years ago, and the cubicles were 66 inches high, 5.5 feet. And the only time you ever saw all the people you're working with was one day there was an earthquake. And we were on the 7th floor of this building in downtown Portland, Oregon. There was an earthquake, and all the heads started popping up above the cubicles. And it reminded me of a prairie dog village after the coyotes have left. You know, so that is not a good place to work. And if you want to see something funny about this, Conan O'Brien has a film on YouTube where he visits the Intel headquarters in California with the same 66-inch cubes, and just to have his take on what it is like to work there. So we got to design buildings for people. I know in Alaska, everybody wants to be outdoors. And sort of the corollary is, if you got to be indoors, you might as well see what's going on outdoors. I think that's sort of the first corollary of a good building design. Well, you know, the next big thing is the so-called triple bottom line. Green buildings are good for profit, planet, and people all together. So it's really important to keep all of those things in mind when we're designing buildings, not just about the dollars. And when you make the business case, here's a good example. This is a study by C.B. Richard Ellis, which is the largest property management firm in the world, the University of San Diego. And what they did is surveyed tenants in LEED buildings. And over half of the tenants said they were more productive in these buildings where they had daylighting, good views to the outdoors, better indoor air quality. And the average gain in productivity, this is self-assessed, so it's not 100% verified, but it's very suggestive, is 5% gain in productivity, which has a value, if you play it out, of about $21 a square foot. And I'll bet that's about the average rent in Anchorage, something like that. In other words, just the gain in productivity is equal to the cost of the building. Think about that. Why is that? Because we spend 100 times more on people in buildings than we do on energy. So if I could gain 5% in productivity, that's 5 times my energy bill in real dollars. So that, you know, that I just want you to think about that for a minute, that energy savings is important, renewables are important, but the real cost of doing business is people in today's economy. And then 45% said they had fewer sick days, an average of just about 3 days less, and a value of the reduced sick days of about $5 a square foot. So when somebody tells you you can't build green because it costs $5 a square foot more, you know, 3%, 4%, look at these kind of numbers and say, well, if I build a building that's better for people, I'm going to get all that money back really fast, if I'm the owner and I'm paying those people. So the whole story of sort of green building being really important for carbon reduction, you get numbers like 30 to 50% reductions in energy use. I'm just looking at Stephanie because she's going to have to tell me if I'm missing the slide because I can't see them. 30 to 50% reduction in energy use, 35% reduction average in carbon emissions, 40% water, 75% waste generation. So there's a lot of good reasons to do this stuff. And then if you sort of play out other reasons, more business reasons, increase in rental rates, increase in occupancy of office buildings, this happens, increase in productivity, reductions in operating costs, reductions in absenteeism and illness. So there's a lot of benefits. In fact, Walmart has been one of the leaders in this area. Walmart discovered about 10 years ago that in buildings that had daylighting, so they actually had a building with skylights, and they found that those departments that were under the skylights we're selling more, like 5% more. And if you know the grocery business or the sort of Walmart type business, 5% gain in revenues is huge because they operate on like 1% margins. So Walmart found that, and then they would move the departments around so different departments were under the skylights so they could verify this wasn't just an aberration. Because if you go into a store and you're under the kind of awful fluorescence that a lot of stores are in, you can't really see the true color of things, and you just don't feel as good. So now Walmart builds every store with skylights. Even though they're 24/7 and they only get the use of the skylights, obviously, in the daylight hours, they do every store 24/7 because there's a gain in retail sales. So a lot of this stuff is you gotta be in the business to know. But once you understand what the leaders are doing, it's being adopted everywhere in the retail industry. Costco's doing it and so forth. It's kind of like that saying about dog sled teams, right? Only the lead dog has a change of scenery. So Walmart is kind of the lead dog in the retail business, and everyone is following them so they don't have to be in the secondary position. Why build green? Well, if you take a 30-year or one-generation perspective, in the United States, you know, we're still growing. This is different, by the way, than in Western Europe. Western Europe is not growing, you know, except for Tunisian refugees and a few other folks that are coming across the Mediterranean. Western Europe is at zero population growth today, in fact, losing people. Russia is losing 1 million or 2 million people a year right now. Germany lost 500,000 people in population last year. So we're growing. So over the next 30 years, we're going to basically build new or refurbish about 75% of our building stock. So we have a chance to do a really good job over that period of time. So, you know, I think this is a great job if you're a young person in the audience. This is a great career because we can basically transform our energy environment, our sort of CO2 production, just by working in buildings. And I think that's pretty cool. And so what's the opportunity to build green? Well, if you kind of look at this chart, hopefully it's showing you there. Over the next 30 years, we're going to demolish about 1/6 of our building stock, currently 300 billion square feet. We're going to demolish about 50 billion. We're going to remodel about half, and we're going to add 150 billion of new construction. So that's a lot of stuff over 30 years. And so about 75% of building stock is going to get touched over that period of time. So here's the thing about building energy. Everyone's concerned about reducing carbon emissions in the world. The only thing that reduces carbon emissions where you actually make money is investing in building energy efficiency and renewables. Every other method that we've come up with costs you money. So again, this is something that's going to happen because it's economically driven. And I think that's a really good news. And about 25% of the total carbon solution can come from buildings. So let's kind of drill down now to green building. You know, I'm a numbers guy. I like statistics when they're in my favor, like most people. And so the U.S. Green Building Council, which in the early part of the last decade was the fastest growing nonprofit in the United States, went from basically a couple hundred hardy souls to 20,000 members in a 5-year period. And by the way, these are businesses, not individuals. So the U.S. Green Building Council still has, with the recession, they lost some members, but still about 16,000 corporate members. There's about 28,000 projects that are registered for LEED certification. So what that means, it's kind of like getting engaged. It's like William and Kate, you know? And then when you actually certify the building, it's like what's going to take place, what, Friday? Is that the big deal? Tomorrow? Is that the big deal? So you register the building, you declare your intention to do something in the future, and then you actually go forward and do it. So the last time I was here, I had a great visit to the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, Jack Hebert's brainchild. And you know, it was a fantastic building. You know, it was a LEED gold, is Jack around, something like, I think, platinum, sorry. So platinum is, as most of the ladies will know, platinum is more valuable than gold. So it is a LEED platinum building. It's a fantastic piece of work, and it shows that you can do it anywhere. And even though I was there in January, where their green roof was a bit white, it's a great piece of work. And so we're seeing this stuff replicated in a whole lot of places. And I think Jack told me it was the northernmost LEED Platinum building in the world, right? So, you know, a lot of distinction here and a lot of lessons to learn from. And so there's about 7,000 of these certified projects. As I mentioned, that these are all commercial I'm talking about. So the housing's a different story. But 7,000 commercial projects averaging 100,000 square feet. So that's more than half a billion square feet of projects already gone through this process. And about 155,000 LEED accredited professionals. And just by way of giving that number some context, that's twice the membership of the American Institute of Architects. In other words, we have an effectively trained all the architects and engineers and builders in the country in how to do this over the last 10 years. And so the knowledge base is there. What we need to do is make the business case. And of course, I give these numbers because one of my favorite sayings from the famous statistician W. Edwards Deming is, "In God we trust, all others must bring data." So this is why I think these numbers are important, is to understand this. And if you look at the next chart, you don't have to read the numbers, but you could just see the growth rate, 2006 being on the left, 7, 8, 9, 10. Understand that this green building thing is growing at the same time the building industry is going through the worst recession in 80 years. What does that tell you? It tells you green building is gaining market share rapidly. This is how the future is going to be. And if you take a look at sort of the next big challenge, is going to be greening existing buildings, because after all, we only add 1 or 2% to the building stock every year. So if we don't tackle existing buildings, we're never going to get the kind of changes in energy use, moving towards energy independence that we talk about, without tackling existing buildings. Because buildings and building products for buildings generate almost 50% of US carbon emissions. It is not cars and trucks. It's not industry, because we've offshored all the industry to China. It's buildings. So if we don't work on buildings, we don't get where we need to go. And so in 2010, there were 900 new projects under the LEED for existing building operation and maintenance standard. Those buildings average about 300,000 square feet in size. So if you do 300,000 times 900, you get 300 million roughly square feet. In 1 year of buildings that are already owned and operated, we can do better. Somebody said it's not just the low-hanging fruit, it's the fruit on the floor that we can pick up and gain some benefit with. And so examples, C.B. Richard Ellis, I mentioned earlier, has already done 100 buildings certified that they don't even own, they just operate them. Because they're a first-class operator, and they understand if you operate buildings better, tenants are gonna stay in them longer. That is a no-brainer if you're in the property business. The Merchandise Mart, which is the largest single building in the United States, 4 million square feet, has done one of these certifications. The Empire State Building is going through one now. And so if you look at this sort of graph of growth, you could see that LEED for existing buildings is one of the fastest growing green building things out there. So the Empire State Building I mentioned is going through an energy retrofit. By 2012, they will have taken this 80-year-old building, the icon of American skyscrapers, and gotten 38% energy savings out of it. And one of the ways they're doing that, which actually might be relevant for Alaska, is they are remanufacturing on site all 6,500 windows at the rate of about 100 a night. And they actually put a new infrared reflective film in between two sheets of glass, remake the window, and put it back by morning. The Willis Tower in Chicago, which I think is the tallest building in the US, 104 stories, now called the, used to be called Sears Tower, they're gonna do the same thing with 15,000 windows. So you don't have to accept a bad building envelope. you know, and then try to make it all work with the, you know, equipment efficiencies. You can actually go through and remanufacture and reinstall all the windows in your buildings as a method of energy efficiency. And by the way, this project has less than a 5-year payback. It's part of a major renovation of the Empire State Building. And in doing this, because they're going to add about 20% to the tenant square footage in that building, they will save enough on energy to avoid having to upgrade and add to the whole HVAC plant. So the real rationale for this project is a standard one. I'm going to have more people in the building paying more rent and therefore using more energy unless I do something. And so that's the project. But again, you could take an 80-year-old building, middle New York City, and you can do an energy upgrade of almost 40%. So I think that's pretty interesting. You can also use green as a branding tool. And so here's an example, a supermarket chain in Massachusetts called Stop and Shop. They took the lead for existing building standard. They applied it to 50 buildings. You can do this in office and retail properties, government buildings. I was in Saskatchewan giving a talk in October, and the provincial government is taking one of the buildings in downtown Regina, and they're actually retrofitted that to LEED standards. So you can do this with all of your buildings. You save water and energy costs. There's a supermarket chain called Super Value, which I think is the second largest in the U.S. They own Albertsons. Do you have Albertsons up here? But in the Northwest, it's pretty big. And they actually have been able, just by relooking at all of their operations, they have taken waste handling from a cost to a profit center over the last 5 years. In other words, they make money out of their waste. Instead of paying someone to take it away, they get paid for their waste. Of course, we all put it on those container ships that are going back to China empty and send it there. But the point is, there is so much money to be made in looking at green buildings in a whole different way. And so the business case really revolves around money. So I'm going to save money on operations, energy use, water use, waste management. It involves getting investments for buildings. It involves mitigating the risk, market risk, and other risks of buildings. It's a marketing and PR tool. It involves productivity and health, as I mentioned earlier. Recruitment and retention, you know, you don't think about it right now, but the first large LEED Platinum building in the U.S. was a biotech company called Genzyme in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They had 900 people working in this building. It was finished in 2004. I had a tour in 2008. The facility guy told me that their turnover of employees since they moved into that building had gone down 5%. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but the average cost of losing and replacing a knowledge worker employee is about $50,000 a year. That turnover was worth $2.5 million a year to them every year, or about $6 a square foot. So for them to spend $5 or even $10 a square foot extra on the green measures to get better daylighting, better energy efficiency, better indoor air quality, that got paid back over and over again every year because people liked working there. It's amazing how that works. If people like working in a place, they'll put up with a lot of other stuff and stay in that place. And so for that company, and so it was worth it.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with green energy expert, author, and consultant Jerry Udelson. He gave the keynote address at the Business of Clean Energy in Alaska conference hosted by REAP at the Dena'ina Center on April 28th.
And so the point I want to make, other companies do green for sustainability reasons. The important thing about understanding the business case is you have to articulate it to the people who care about that. And I always like to say the world is run by the people who sign the front of the check, right? Most of us like to sign the back, pay to the order of me. But the people who sign the front of the check, who make investments, who sort of drive change, are the people you have to convince. And so I think that the numbers stuff is really valuable for that reason. So here's an example of an outfit called CoStar. Now, CoStar is the largest commercial property database in the country. 2 million properties, office properties, are in that database. And since about 2004, they have been tagging all of their properties with whether they are an Energy Star rated. Most of you know Energy Star. It's the top 25% of building energy performance in the country in various categories, or a LEED building. So they've got a 4 or 5, 6 years now of data. And it's been studied by a lot of academics in both Europe and the US. So Energy Star buildings have a rent premium, $2.40 a square foot, which is almost 10%, and higher occupancy and selling for about $6 a square foot more when they're resold. If you look at LEED buildings, now this is data from about 2009. So the LEED buildings were $11 a square foot rent premium. That's almost a 30% rent premium because the rents are higher in big cities. 4% higher occupancy. So that means if a building had 85%, a normal building, 85% occupancy, it would have 89% in a LEED building. And these buildings sold at $174 a square foot more. So huge gain in sales value. Another way to look at it is a rent premium, and I won't sort of bore you with all the details, but you could see the average rents are falling at the end of 2009, but the LEED buildings still had a 10% rent premium. So even in the depths of the recession, people who owned these buildings were getting more rents. And if you're in the real estate business, that means real money. So again, these are really interesting pieces of data. If you look at the LEED rental rates versus peers, you could see it was pretty large and then kind of got smaller, but still stayed about 10% bigger over time. If you look at the occupancy rates, the LEED buildings are actually, the LEED buildings are actually showing greater occupancy rates than their peers. And a peer means within a quarter mile, at least a four-story office building, at least 200,000 square feet, at least Class A office. So, you know, as much apples to apples as you could get. So again, certainly things are different in Alaska than in the lower 48 real estate markets, but you're seeing this phenomenon everywhere in the US and you're seeing it in Europe. So I gotta believe it's gonna happen here. Another study that was done out of the UK looked at about 900 certified buildings versus 10,000 non-certified. And if you understand statistics, you understand those are pretty good numbers. Effective rent 6% higher, sales percent 16% higher, and a green upgrade would add about 5.5% to the value of a building. A survey done by Cornet Global, which is the corporate real estate people worldwide, and Jones Lang LaSalle, which is the second largest property management company, just recently found in 2010, 50% of corporate real estate executives were willing to pay more rent for green buildings, up from almost only 13% the year before. Pay up to 10% more rent for being in a green building, and 73% would pay more for buildings with lower energy costs. 92% considered sustainability and location decisions, 31% productivity and health. So we still got a lot of education to do on that topic. But the point here is that smart people who spend money and are judged on the results are going in this direction. And so I think that's really a very strong business case. I mentioned productivity. Lots of studies of green buildings are showing 3 to 7% gains in productivity. And remember, I said a 1% gain in productivity pays the whole energy bill in most buildings. So again, these are things that really count. And the cost premiums in the range of 2%. I worked with a large shopping center developer about 3 or 4 years ago now, and we looked at, in detail, costing out LEED buildings for shopping centers. And we found this 1.5 to 2% cost premium. But when you actually played out the effect of that on the return on investment, it was 0.15% less return on investment. So if you're in the commercial real estate business and you are selling to investors, and you could give them a green building with all these other attributes and a slightly lower rate of return, you're still going to be in business. Not only that, you're going to get and keep better employees. because your people care about this stuff, not just your customers or your investors, but young people today care about an organization's commitment to sustainability. They care about the future they're going to be living in for a long time. And so getting and keeping good people as we come out of the recession, as unemployment goes down again, is going to be one of the major drivers of green. So if you have to sum it all up, the business case, I think, is really solid. It's important to get out in front. I wrote a book 4 years ago now called The Green Building Revolution. I was sort of saying all this stuff's going to happen, and in fact, it did. But it's important to get out in front because you've got to learn your own lessons. The first project you do isn't going to be as good as the last project. One of my favorite examples is a developer in Portland, Oregon, that was doing well over $1 billion a year of new development all throughout the last decade, that made a commitment to lead early on. And so $1 billion of other people's money is still a lot of money. And so they have done like 50 lead projects now. As a developer, no subsidies, hard money, you got to get the tenants once you build it, et cetera. And they will tell you that they keep learning. So the important thing is to get started, to share information. There's certainly a role for the government here to capture the lessons learned and disseminate them to people. But we know that these things create value in triple bottom line terms. We now know how to build green on a conventional budget, which is really important. It's also important to green existing buildings to prevent what I will call value erosion. If you have an older office building or commercial building, and the ones around you start to get Energy Star certified and LEED certified, you're not going to be able to get the same rents and the same tenants as the other buildings. So the value of your real estate erodes. So again, as a preventive measure, this is very useful. And for the state as a whole, you're really going to build a profitable base of green jobs, products, technologies, and know-how, which is exportable elsewhere. So I think the next big thing I call zero net energy buildings. I call them zone buildings. I think that's a better acronym than the one that's being used as ZNE or ZEB, something like that. I like zone, you can remember. But if you start with efficient building design, I actually did a quick calculation. You could actually do a net zero building here in Alaska. Now, 6 months of the year, a solar building isn't going to yield much, right? But the other 6 months, it's going to yield a lot. And so as solar technology costs come down and as the productivity goes up, you're looking at a factor of 4 on the cost efficiency of solar over the next 5 years. It will be 4 times as cost effective 5 years from now as it is today. So you could do a very energy efficient building here, put the solar on top, and do a zero net energy building. And I think that would be, Jack, that would be a great next project for you up there in Fairbanks to see if you could make that happen. And so who's going to benefit from this? Well, I listed a whole bunch of things: government offices, corporate offices, commercial offices, universities, research institutions, schools, NGOs, non-government institutions, and maybe others. And so the next big thing after zero net energy is going to be what I call smart cities. And so what's happening out there is a convergence between buildings, software, energy use, and smart systems for information, smart vehicles, because you know now the big thing is the hybrids and hybrid electrics and all electric vehicles. We're going to start rethinking our homes and our businesses as energy consumers and start to look at them as energy producers. And so I think that's sort of the next big thing. And all of this is going to be mediated in sort of the internet cloud by information technology. And so I think looking ahead, this is a great time to really think about, well, how can we get ahead? How can we work with people, progressive groups like the Coast Guard and others, to get ahead and start using some of these new technologies in our buildings, find out what works in this situation, and move forward into this new energy information, smart vehicle, smart home, smart building economy. So that's why I like to say the future is green. I understand that hockey is played up here from time to time, so I have a good hockey picture for you. But skate to where the puck is headed, not to where it is, that old Wayne Gretzky line. And ask yourself, well, what is the built environment going to look like in 2015, 2016? What's going to be the next normal? And build accordingly. So that, with that, I'm going to wind it up. Thank you very much. And I'll show you some resources here.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with green energy expert, author, and consultant Jerry Udelson. He gave the keynote address at the Business of Clean Energy in Alaska conference hosted by REAP at the Dena'ina Center on April 28th. Following his talk, Mr. Udelson responded to questions submitted by audience members.
So it looks like we've got maybe a comment here. It says, the green building should be a good fit for accessibility building. About a decade ago, I saw a report on the value of making a new home accessible, since the upfront cost was 12% more, but resale was 25% more. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I noticed in the morning sessions, Alaskans are more prone to be giving comments than questions. So I don't know why we need these cards. All of you are leather-lunged enough just to shout out the questions. But I do think it's important that you understand that green building design doesn't replace other things like universal design for accessibility. And as the U.S. population starts to age and people want to age in place, so to speak, we've got to really think about, well, how do you get in and out of the house when you're a bit creakier than you were 25 years ago? And those of us who are getting a bit older, and will in fact admit it, understand that, you know, you get around differently. In fact, I saw this great experiment the other day of a young woman researcher who was outfitted like her grandmother would move. And it was really interesting to see sort of visually how you would have to convince somebody what it's like to move in an older body, you know, with things that don't turn as much and things that don't move as much and so forth. So homes need to work for people of all ages, but I look at the green design as a supplement to good architectural design, as a supplement to good building design, and not as something that's going to stand by itself. Do you think Sarah Palin has a chance to get the Republican nomination? No. Have we enough energy collection surfaces on extant buildings, existing buildings, to supply all U.S. energy? How to store it annually? You know, it's really interesting. If you look at where all the big solar power plants are going in the California, Arizona, Nevada deserts, the biggest issue is energy storage. I remember seeing some studies from the first big surge of renewable energy that when you start to put more than 20 or 30% solar and wind power into the grid can get unstable. So the big thing now in energy is storage. And so there are these large solar power plants being built with central towers and then mirrors shining the sun onto towers. And they're actually storing it for 3 or 4 hours after sunset as molten salt. And then using that really molten salt at 500, 600, 700 degrees Fahrenheit to make steam and turn generators. So energy storage is going to turn out to be a huge issue. And I always look at this, well, that's a great business opportunity. So people talk about storage in compressed air. They talk about storage in pump storage reservoirs. Energy storage is going to be a huge issue. And getting battery technology to come along, et cetera. If any of you have iPads and iPhones, you know, storage technology still has a ways to go. So I think that not only can we collect all the energy, by the way, there is enough area in all of the bombing ranges in the California desert to supply the entire United States with solar power. So unfortunately, there's a bit of an unexploded ordnance problem. there, but there's not a lot of wildlife to worry about, guaranteed. We don't need the whole U.S., but we need a certain piece of it. We could supply the entire U.S. And by the way, in Western Europe, there's serious discussion of using North Africa as a solar farm for Western Europe. Because if you really look at North Africa away from the coast, there's nothing there except sun and sand, right? And so the Europeans are talking about actually producing solar power in the Sahara and sending it under the Mediterranean, because it's only a 9-mile stretch under the Strait of Gibraltar, sending it under the Mediterranean in high voltage cable to power Western Europe in the wintertime. So, you know, there's lots of interesting schemes afloat, but energy storage, transfer between day and night, transfer between summer and winter is a big issue. So, yeah, there's great opportunities to do that. You know, I worked for a governor of California for 4 years, and one thing I learned with that governor is you always answer the question you think somebody should have asked you instead of the one they actually asked you. So if it doesn't quite match, you'll understand why. Where do we find published data on decreasing lead design costs? There's a wonderful author named Gregory Katz, K-A-T-S, who's just written a book called, I think, Greening Our World or Greening Our Built Environment. And he has collected all of these studies on both costs and benefits. Just came out last year, so it's pretty current stuff. So I would recommend him. And of course, I have data in my various books on lead costs. But I think where you really get the best cost data is from real projects. You know, that is, David Johnson talked about a project today that came in under budget. I was with an engineering firm in Portland, Oregon in 2003 to 2006 timeframe. We designed what until very recently was the largest LEED Platinum building in the U.S. It was a developer-driven project, and the HVAC, mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems came in 12% below the original budget through integrated design. So I was inspired by that to write a book called Green Building Through Integrated Design. It's published by McGraw-Hill. And we tried to look at LEED Platinum projects and what they really cost when the process was done right. And I think the real lesson learned over the last decade is it's not about bolting it on new technology. It's about building it in through a better design process. So I would say to the university, to the state government, city government, anyone who's commissioning a new project is focus on process management first, and the green results will happen after that. I think I did answer the question. I'm losing it. With 5,000 plus LEED buildings constructed, what proportion are not in the public sector? How do we grow green building without subsidy or mandate? Well, in fact, over half of the LEED projects total are in the private sector, those guys that sign the front of the check. And most of the LEED for existing building projects are in the private sector, 80% when I wrote the book on that a year and a half ago. So all of those business case reasons are real because people are doing it. And I'm sort of a behavioralist. If you watch what people are doing instead of what they say and study the reasons why, you're probably going to find out something useful. And so I look at all these business people doing LEED buildings, you know, as well as the government and the Obama administration, certainly been very proactive in this area. But I look at all these business people from large corporations to individual entrepreneurs doing green buildings on their own nickel, and I say there must be something there. It's that old story, you know, if there's enough horse manure, there must be a pony somewhere. So I see this happening and I say, why? And you go find out and they'll tell you why. I get higher rents, I get better tenants. I was on a trade mission 5 years ago in Shanghai, and the U.S. government sets up these round robins with people you want to meet. I call it speed dating with developers. But I met with all these developers in Shanghai, and if you know anything about China, you know money is all there is, today's world in China. And I said, why are you building green buildings, certified LEED buildings? And they said, because we will attract the better tenants. We will get the multinational corporations as tenants, and they won't skip out on their rent the way Chinese companies might do if things don't go well. And so that's a good reason for me. You're going to spend a couple $100,000 extra on a 75-story office building to get better tenants? That's nothing. So I see this happening worldwide. There are now 70 green building councils, national green building councils around the world. They're all over the Middle East. You know, they're all over Asia. They're all over the Pacific. There's green building councils in Jordan, in Turkey, in Poland, in Russia. This is happening everywhere. So I feel like an evangelist for the obvious. So this is the last one. We're having too much fun to stop, but I guess other things are happening. If solar panels can be taken off a building when the building owner changes, can the solar qualify for LEED points? That's a really interesting question. Those of you who have been around a while know that we had this big solar boom in the late 70s, early 80s, and a lot of those panels were in fact taken off of buildings. They weren't maintained. New owners came in. Ronald Reagan took the panels off, solar panels, took Jimmy Carter's solar panels off the White House, literally. He took a lot of things else of Jimmy Carter's, but he took the solar panels off the White House. And just it was like a statement, like, you know, hey, we're not them. So if you took, if part of your certification was that we're going to do solar and then you took the panels off, you certainly get the Bad Boy of the Year award. But every 5 years now, every LEED certified building has to be recertified. So you might have a platinum building today, and when you go to recertify it, it might just be a pewter, plain LEED building. So don't do it. That's my message. You know, I read this solar panels, and it did look like Sarah Palin to my old eyes. So if Sarah Palin is taken off a building, what can you say about it? So that's the end of our fun here today. Thank you so much for the invitation. Have a great conference.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with green energy expert, author, and consultant Jerry Udelson. He responded to questions submitted by audience members following his talk entitled The Business Case for Green Building in Alaska, recorded at the Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, hosted by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project at the Dena'ina Center on April 28, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.